The reading tonight is Daniel chapter 5, page 897. That's Daniel 5, page 897. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's colour changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his colour changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your colour change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines, have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honoured." Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson." This is the interpretation of the matter. "Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with a purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old.
Should we pray? Our Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your word, that it is living and active, and sharper than any two-edged sword, and that it does pierce the division of soul and spirit, of joint and marrow. And so, Father, we do pray that as we look at Daniel chapter 5 now, you would speak to us by your Spirit, and that you would strengthen and encourage and rebuke us as necessary. Amen. On the 17th of April in 1975, Phnom Penh, the capital city of Cambodia, fell to the invading armies of the Khmer Rouge. For the next 4 years, they ruled Cambodia under Pol Pot. And Don Cormack, a missionary out in Cambodia, described the situation in his book, Killing Fields, Living Fields. Referring to a time 2 months before the fall of that capital city, he wrote, "By now, Phnom Penh was in the throes of death. The tightening noose of the Khmer Rouge pressed in all around her, while from within she was being slowly stifled and crushed by the weight of over 2 million refugees. Soon she would be a ghost town, her empty streets and looted buildings strewn with litter and corpses, her people sent away to a four-year-long gulag. Closed off and largely ignored by the outside world, the cries of Phnom Penh's stampeding millions would be heard by death's gates alone." And for the Cambodian church, he wrote, "This was but the beginning of their long, agonized cry as they entered the most terrifying trial yet of their painful history. 90% of the church and virtually all leaders and pastors would perish." I'm sure that Christians in Cambodia and many outside that country ask the question, is God really in control of history? Does he really rule over kings and their kingdoms? Because you look at Cambodia's history, and particularly at the history of the church in that country, it doesn't look like it, does it? If God does rule the kingdoms of mankind, how could he allow a regime that sets itself up against him, that defies him and his church? It looks like God is weak and impotent in the face of great, powerful, mighty leaders. Well, these would have been exactly the questions and thoughts of the Jews of Daniel's time. Some of them, God's own people, had been exiled from Jerusalem and taken into captivity in Babylon, that great pagan superpower of the day. Was God really in control over kings and rulers? It certainly didn't look it. How could he allow his people to be exiled by a pagan king? And not just that, but some of the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem that were used for worshipping God were also taken. They were defiled and placed in the treasury of the Babylonian gods. As Daniel says in chapter 1, verse 2, which says, "And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God." Was God in control over rulers and kingdoms? It didn't look it. It looked like God was utterly defeated and weak. It looked like he was no match for the mighty, powerful Babylonian gods. And at the start of today's passage, we see the Babylonian king Belshazzar adding to that by setting himself up against God in great, blatant defiance. He literally spits in God's face. Now, to set the scene, this chapter of Daniel occurred several years after the passage we were looking at last week, after chapter 4. So King Nebuchadnezzar, that we were hearing about last week, has now died. There's been a time of relative political instability within the Babylonian Empire, and over quite a short period of time there have been several kings come and go. And then this king, King Belshazzar, becomes on the throne. And this chapter, Daniel 5, is set right at the close of his reign. So at the start of the passage we hear about Belshazzar holding a big feast. So on one particular evening, Belshazzar decides to hold a great feast, doesn't he, for all his lords and his noblemen. He's invited them all to this great banquet, and 1,000 of them turn up for the party. Can you imagine the scene? Belshazzar seated on his throne, looking great, powerful and mighty. In fact, the aim of the whole feast is to show his lords just how great, and mighty he is. And then the banqueting starts, the food is served, rich, sumptuous food, and you begin to think, yes, Belshazzar must be a truly great king. And the wine begins to flow. And as Belshazzar begins to have a bit too much to drink, he decides that he's so great that he'll get out the gold and silver vessels and cups that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem when he'd invaded Judah. Gold and silver vessels that belonged to the temple in Jerusalem that were used for the worship of the Most High God. They were such beautiful cups and vessels, they'd be great to drink from, wouldn't they? And again, everybody would think how great Belshazzar is when they see such great cups and vessels. And so the vessels are brought out from the storeroom, and everyone at the feast starts to drink from them. And as they drink, they start to worship. But not the God of Israel. Not the God that these vessels have been made for the worship of. Instead, they start to worship the gods of gold, of silver, of bronze, of iron, of stone and wood. Belshazzar and his lords worship the gods of gold and silver and wood and stone with the very vessels that were made to worship the true and living God, the God of Israel, the Most High God. Belshazzar defies God. He's sticking up two fingers before God, isn't he? He's spitting in the face of God as he worships these other gods with the vessels made for the worship of the one true God. Effectively, Belshazzar's saying, who are you, God? You're nothing compared to me. You're nothing compared to my greatness, my rule. You're so puny and pathetic. I mean, you couldn't even stop your people being invaded and exiled. In the face of such blatant pride and desecration, what will God do? Will he let his name and reputation be dishonoured? Will God act? Or maybe another question for the Jews would be, can God act? Or is their God pathetic and weak in the face of a great superpower like Babylon? Well, immediately a great hand appears, doesn't it, and starts to write on the wall. Imagine sitting here now one Sunday evening and all of a sudden a hand appears out of nowhere and starts writing on the wall. How would you respond? What do you feel? Well, verse 6 describes the king's response. Then the king's colour changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. He's like a lump of jelly on the floor, isn't he? His limbs give way, his knees knock. So much for all of Belshazzar's apparent greatness and power. He's utterly terrified. He's quaking in his boots. He's a quivering wreck. What is this hand? What is this writing? What would you do in a situation like that? You'd call in your experts, wouldn't you? Well, that's exactly what the king does. He calls in the enchanters, the astrologers, the wise men of Babylon, and says to them in verse 7, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Surely they'll be able to read the writing that's on the wall. Surely they'll be able to interpret it, to explain what it means. After all, that's their job, isn't it? They're the experts. But when they come in, the writing's a mystery to them. They can't read it. They can't understand it. It's just like gobbledygook to them. Imagine the situation. There's a crisis in the world somewhere, and you switch on the 10 o'clock news to watch what the BBC have to say and see what they reckon on the situation. And there's the interview. You've got the newscaster, and he sort of says, answers some questions to the expert. And the expert just sits there blankly and says, I don't know what's going on. It's a mystery to me. What's happening? I haven't got the foggiest. We'd be pretty shocked, wouldn't we, and surprised. Well, that's exactly Belshazzar's situation. All his hopes of understanding the writing are dashed. And so verse 9, the king is now greatly alarmed. His colour continues to change and his lords are now also perplexed. Can you sense the fear, the alarm, the uncertainty? What is going on? What does it all mean? Will it remain a mystery forever? Is there anyone who can read the writing and explain it? Well, then the king comes striding into the banqueting hall. She's heard all the commotion that's been going on out there. She's heard about this mysterious hand and the writing on the wall that no one can read. And so she says to Belshazzar in verse 10, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your colour change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret the dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel. What a relief. Can you sense the king's relief? At last, there is someone who can explain it. Daniel has the spirit of the holy gods. He has wisdom like the wisdom of gods. Nebuchadnezzar Belshazzar's predecessor made Daniel the chief of the magicians and astrologers because he had this excellent spirit and understanding. Call Daniel, the queen says. He'll be able to explain this mysterious writing to you. And so Daniel gets wheeled in before the king, doesn't he? And the king says to Daniel in verse 13, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that the light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men and enchanters have been brought in before me to read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show me the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems." The king is hoping that Daniel can read the writing and explain just what is going on. But do you see the irony? Belshazzar has to rely on one of the exiles of Judah to explain to him the writing and its meaning. Belshazzar has just been dishing the God of Israel, hasn't he? He's been spitting in his face. And now he has to rely on Daniel, who fears in that God, for the interpretation. Things don't bode well. Well, so much for Belshazzar being such a great and mighty and powerful king. So just to recap the situation, he's like a lump of jelly, sat on the floor, quivering, terrified, and now he's begging one of these exiles to explain the writing to him. And so we come to have a look at the first part of Daniel's speech. And so he answers and says to the king, verse 17, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and let your rewards be for another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." Phew. At long last, someone is going to read the writing and explain it. At last, the mystery will be solved. Verse 18. "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of all the greatness he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he killed, whom he would he kept alive, whom he would he raised up, and whom he would he humbled." Daniel tells Belshazzar, the Most High God, that the Most High God, the God who is above all gods and rulers and powers, gave to Nebuchadnezzar the throne of Babylon. That is why Nebuchadnezzar was king, because God had given it to him, as we saw last week. And God also gave to him the greatness, the glory, the majesty that went with it. And the reason all the peoples and nations and languages feared him and trembled before him was because God had given him that greatness. Because of the God-given greatness of Nebuchadnezzar, he had the authority to kill or keep alive or to exalt or to humble. And yet, verse 20, "But when his heart," that's Nebuchadnezzar's heart, "was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules over the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will." Although the rule and authority was given to by Nebuchadnezzar from God, yet Nebuchadnezzar didn't recognize it, did he, as we saw last week, that it was God-given. As we heard last week, Nebuchadnezzar said, "Is this not great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence for the glory of my majesty?" Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up against the Most High God, and he acted proudly. And so God humbled him. God took away all that he had previously given Nebuchadnezzar. He took away his throne in Babylon. He took away his glory. God drove him away from mankind and made his mind like that of an animal. He became like an animal and lived among the animals. He ate grass like the animals. And this continued until Nebuchadnezzar knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of men and sets over it whom he will, verse 21. In other words, until Nebuchadnezzar knew that he was the king of Babylon only because God had given it to him, he remained like an animal. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't king because of anything he'd done, because of his might or power or wisdom. No, it was only because of that God had given him the throne. At this point, you might be thinking, well, that's a nice history lesson, Daniel. We know all this. We sort of heard it all last week, didn't we? I thought you were going to explain the hand and the writing. There's still that big mystery we're waiting to have explained. Some help you are. Well, maybe if that's what you're thinking, have a little patience. He's getting there. So Daniel continues with his speech. So we move on to the second part, verses 22 and 23. So verse 22. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew this. But you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords, your wives and concubines have drunk from them. And you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and in whose are all your ways, you have not honoured. You see, the history lesson is important, isn't it? You could say, like father, like son. Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar's father, or predecessor, lifted himself up against the Most High God and was humbled by God. Well, you'd think that Belshazzar would have learnt the lesson, wouldn't you? You would have thought he'd learnt the lesson that God rules, and so be wise and to humble himself before God. And yet that is exactly what Belshazzar doesn't do. You have not humbled your heart, but have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And as I reread verse 22, listen for the big shock in the verse. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. Isn't that shocking? Belshazzar knew all this. It's not that Belshazzar was just ignorant or not sure if there was a God. He knew all about Nebuchadnezzar. He knew the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar had learnt. He knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. So Belshazzar knowingly and deliberately sets himself up against God and acts in great defiance of God. Verse 23 lists how he acted in defiance. So he acted proudly, thinking how great he was and wanting others to think how great he was. He drank from the gold and silver vessels from God's temple in Jerusalem, vessels that should have been used in the worship of the Most High God, whom he knew about. He praised the gods of gold and silver, wood, bronze, iron, stone, gods which do not see or hear. And yet, he has not praised or honoured the Most High God, the God in whose hand is Belshazzar's breath, his very life. It's unbelievably stupid, isn't it? I was camping recently down in Dorset, and during the days we were walking along the coastal path, the south coastal path, between Lulworth Cove and Swanage. And at one point on the path we were walking on, we were just a few metres away from a sheer cliff edge. But the way the land was meant that actually you couldn't see the cliff edge was there. As far as you're aware, it just probably went on for quite a bit beyond it. So apart from the little frequent signs that sort of said, danger, cliff, we wouldn't have known there was a cliff. Now, you'd think I was pretty stupid, wouldn't you, if I don't reckon there is a cliff there. I mean, I've heard people in the group talking about it, that there is a cliff there, I've seen the signs. And if I decide, no, I think I like the look of that direction, I'm sure there's plenty of land, I'm going to walk in that direction. You'd think me incredibly stupid, wouldn't you? Because the moment I step over that cliff, I'll end up dead at the bottom. It's a very silly illustration, isn't it? But it's a bit like Belshazzar. He knowingly defies God. He purposely acts against the God whom he knows rules heaven and earth. But I guess we still have a question, don't we? What will God do about Belshazzar's outright defiance? Can God do anything about it other than simply sending Daniel to say what's happened? Or verse 24 is the third part of Daniel's speech. Verse 24. Then from his presence, that's God's presence, the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. So God has acted. The hand that wrote on the wall was sent by God. God's done something. And at last, we're back to the writing. We're getting nearer to solving what this mystery is all about. Although it still sounds to be quite a big mystery to me. I mean, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. I don't know if that means anything to you, but it doesn't mean much to me. Well, the words seem to describe different coins that were in current circulation in Babylon. So a modern equivalent might be something like a pound, tuppence, and 50p. No wonder Belshazzar needs Daniel to explain and interpret the writing. So what exactly does it mean? Well, verse 26. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now we need to understand that each of these words, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin, is a pun, so that they can have different meanings. So on one level they simply describe Babylonian coins, but on another level they mean something quite different. So Mene can also mean numbered, as you can see from the footnote in the Bibles and also on the handout as I've printed for you. Tekel can also mean weighed, and Parsin can mean divided. And so Daniel's interpretation of the matter is this: Mene, God has numbered the days of Belshazzar's kingdom and brought it to an end. Now we might say something, mightn't we, like this: Peter's days are numbered. Well, the phrase isn't quite being used in quite that sense here. So rather than referring to an individual person, it's being used to refer to the whole of the Babylonian kingdom. Babylonian's days are numbered, is what Daniel is saying. The superpower will soon pass away. Tekel, you have been weighed and found wanting. This now does refer to Belshazzar. Belshazzar has been weighed on the scales and has been found light, and so judgment is coming upon him. And lastly, Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. The Babylonian kingdom will be divided up. It will be given to the Medes and Persians. It's a devastating judgment, isn't it? It foretells the end of this great superpower and the division of it. And it foretells the end of Belshazzar's reign. Now for a moment, just place yourself in Belshazzar's shoes. If you'd just been told that you've been lifting yourself up against the Most High God and that this major judgment is coming upon you, how would you respond? What would you do? Would you cry out to God for mercy and forgiveness, maybe begging God for another chance? Or would you just think, oh, well, never mind, just small matter. Let's get back to the party. I mean, after all, we were having such a great time before this sort of interruption of this hand thing. Such an annoyance and nuisance. I don't know about you, but I know what I'd do. I'd be on my knees crying out to God for mercy and forgiveness. But what does Belshazzar do? Have a look down at verse 29. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put round his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Belshazzar pretends that nothing's happened. He ignores Daniel's interpretation that judgment is coming and pretends that everything will be fine and okay. Back to the party. That's what he's saying. Belshazzar is as proud as ever. He's rejected the knowledge of God that he had from Nebuchadnezzar and acted in defiance, and he's doing exactly the same thing again now. As he makes Daniel the third highest ruler in the kingdom, again, he's defying God, isn't he? He's saying to God, no, you will not judge me. No, you will not destroy Babylon. And again, don't miss the irony. Daniel gets to be the third highest ruler in Babylon. Wow, great, we might think. But for how long? Remember, judgment is coming. How long do they have to wait for judgment? Well, verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. That very night, judgment came. That very night, Belshazzar was killed, and the Babylonian kingdom passed away to the Medes and the Persians. And so again, we see the lesson of Nebuchadnezzar. God is the Most High God who rules the kingdoms of mankind and sets over them whom he will. God will not allow the proud to defy him. He will act in judgment. The Jews could take great heart, couldn't they? He's not a weak or an impotent God. No, God ruled even over Babylon, that great superpower. And he judged and acted to vindicate his name. He will not be defied. And so what about us? Well, I think we can draw out three implications for us today. So firstly, following on from what we've just said, God does rule. Today, the Most High God still rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over them whom he will. And that should give us great confidence, shouldn't it? Let's go back to the situation of Cambodia under Pol Pot that we thought about at the start. You see, it looks like God doesn't rule over the kingdoms of man. How could he allow 90% of his church in that country to be destroyed? But the reality is he does rule. Often we may not understand why he does what he does, or why he does allow certain people to rule. But just because we don't understand is no reason to surmise that he doesn't rule. He is the Most High God, and he does rule. And because he rules means he judges. Judgment may not and probably won't come as swiftly or as obviously as it did for Belshazzar, but God still judges. So those like Belshazzar who set themselves up against God will face his judgment. Let me read to you from Romans chapter 2 and verse 5. Because of your hard and impenitent heart, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? You are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. God rules over kingdoms, and on the future day he's set, he will judge all those who set themselves up against him, just like Belshazzar. And as we look at our society today, doesn't God look utterly weak and powerless in the face of materialism and secularism? Doesn't God look powerless in the face of the eroding laws of this country, abortion, euthanasia, the recent Joffe bill putting forward physician-assisted suicide that was thankfully wasn't passed? Another example is the Enlightenment, or what's known as the Enlightenment. So in the 18th century, there was a fundamental shift in thinking from God to humanity. Hence, I think, therefore I am. It elevates the I to the role of God. Effectively, I become God. How can I know anything? Well, it relies exclusively on my thoughts, my thinking, my reasoning, not on God and what he thinks and says. It's just another example of how we in our society today defy God and set ourselves up against him. But God will not tolerate it forever. Judgment is coming. But secondly, the real shock is that this describes all of us. Each of us, every one of us here today, naturally lift ourselves up against God and defy him. Each of us acts just like Belshazzar. We all act proudly, lifting ourselves up against God, even while we know that God rules. Would you turn with me to Romans chapter 1? That's on page 1131. Page 1131, Romans 1. So chapter 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and the birds and animals and reptiles. Did you notice the Belshazzar syndrome there? Look at verse 19. What can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. God has plainly, clearly revealed himself in creation. That's just like Belshazzar, isn't it? He knew of God through Nebuchadnezzar. Both us and Nebuchadnezzar know something of God. And yet how does mankind respond? Well, verse 18. the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. We all suppress the truth we know about God. Though we know about God, we reject it. We pretend that we don't know. We all say there is no God when we know full well there is. We all act as if there is no God when we know there is. Well, that's exactly like Belshazzar, isn't it? We said earlier how stupid Belshazzar was for knowingly setting himself up in defiance of God. Well, all of us, me included, are just the same. We're every bit as stupid as Belshazzar. And we've also seen from Belshazzar that God will not tolerate that pride, that arrogance in lifting ourselves up before him. God will judge. So the wise thing to do would be to learn from Belshazzar, wouldn't it? Rather than going on proudly, living proudly, defying God, the wise thing to do would be to humble ourselves before him, before judgment comes and it's too late. And that's what a Christian is. A Christian is simply someone who's recognised that they have been living in proud defiance before God, living like Belshazzar. And it's someone who's responded to that by humbling themselves before God and now seeks to live recognising his authority and his rule over them. It's like we saw with Nebuchadnezzar last week. Let me just read from chapter 4 that we looked at last week. No need to turn to it. At the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honoured him who lives forever. And a bit later on, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just. That's the mark of a Christian. Someone who's humbled themselves before God and is seeking to praise and extol and honour the King of heaven. Rather than acting in proud defiance towards him like Belshazzar. And so if you recognise yourself in Belshazzar, if you recognise that you live in the same way that he did, knowingly rejecting God, lifting yourself up before him, well, please learn from his lesson before it's too late, before judgment comes. Please humble yourself before God and submit to his rule. And lastly, what about those of us here who do recognise Belshazzar's folly, those of us who have learned from him and are now seeking to live lives, recognising that God rules, people like Nebuchadnezzar, if you like? Well, if you're anything like me, you'll know that all too often we still act like Belshazzar, don't we? All too often we still try to lift ourselves up against God. Isn't that the nature of sin? Don't we all too often worship the gods of gold or silver or bronze, wood or iron, and not the God, and not honour the God who holds our lives? We need to ask the question of ourselves, how do I proudly lift myself up before God? How do I not honour God? For example, we do it, don't we, when we fail to trust him and think, I'll provide for myself in my own way. As we do that, we're proudly lifting ourselves up before God, aren't we? We're saying that we know better than him. We might think he's being stingy or whatever, so we seek to provide for ourselves. Maybe it's in the way we use our money. How many of us have indulged in retail therapy or comfort eating? Do you see, as we do those things, we're saying God hasn't given us what we need, or rather what we think we need. Or maybe we set ourselves up in the way we respond to a situation or crisis in our lives. Do we think, I can solve this problem, I can sort it out, independently of God? Maybe we rely on our money or our brains to get out of a scrape. Well, surely the right attitude would be firstly to humbly submit ourselves to God and come to him in prayerful dependence. And each of these ways, and many others, don't we? We lift ourselves up against God. We knowingly reject what God has said and do our own thing instead. Well, let's turn back to God. Let's repent of our sin, knowing that he is faithful and just to forgive us. And let's humbly submit ourselves to the Most High God, who rules over all. We'll now have a short time to reflect on what God said to us and to respond to him in the quietness of our own hearts.
the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. We sang last week for the first time, didn't we, this song, Why Do the Nations Rage and Cry, which picks up the themes of both last week's passage and this week's, where kings and all of us set ourselves up against God.